How does someone become a saint? Well, someone who should know is Brother Donald Blake, a Christian brother and the postulator for the cause of the founder of the Christian Brothers, Blessed Edmund Rice. Now, what is a postulator?
Postulator is the person who deals officially with the Congregation for Causes of Saints in Rome in forwarding the reasons why a certain holy person should be declared either blessed or a saint, to organise all the evidence that is required to bring about that happy situation.
So who decides that someone should become a blessed or a saint?
In many cases, we say for people who have died in the recent past, that process can be reasonably simple, because you can round up the people who are only too anxious to speak about the virtues and the many good deeds done by these friends of theirs, and that can be recorded. This is done under oath, of course, to make sure that people are taking this quite seriously. But as in the case of Edmund Rice, when you're dealing with somebody who died back in 1844, that process, unfortunately, is not available. All the contemporaries are obviously, hopefully, with Edmund in heaven. But then one has to rely very much on documentary evidence, on what was written and spoken about the person during their lives. And of course, what becomes a very important exercise then is to make sure that what is written is accurate, that it is authentic.
So who decides that someone should become a blessed or a saint?
Usually I would suggest it comes from the ground up. It's a kind of a surge of feeling or understanding among people who have known this person in life, or they have known of this person, that they feel that this person is a very good exemplar for living our Christian lives in today's world, in whatever area of life that we are. And they actually suggest that this person would be a good model for people in our times. It usually begins very informally that way, and then people begin to share their memories of the person. They begin maybe to pray together, and word gets round sometimes about, you know, that prayers are being answered for, you know, various requests and so on. And the movement grows, usually by word of mouth. I mean, okay, we've had Mother Teresa recently, who was known all over the world. But for most of our candidates for beatification or canonization, they're usually people who are known in a very limited or in a very small region of the world. And of course, the onus then becomes before a wider world audience to prove that these people have something to offer really to people in similar circumstances in other parts of the world today.
Documentary evidence becomes very important.
It may be letters written by the person. It may be biographies that were written at different times down through the ages. It may be, again, letters that other people wrote to this person or about that person. It may be newspaper reports of the times. It may be evidence given before, we'll say in England, where you had lots of royal commissions or whatever on education or whatever. Really, the evidence has to be searched from all possible sources, and sometimes having exhausted, we'll say, what people who work in libraries and archives and so on can come up with, sometimes one gets leads through word of mouth from people who have had traditions handed down to them through family members and so on. Now, some of these turn out to be false, others are true.
Why does there seem to be a progression from venerable to blessed to saint?
That's tied up really with how the person's fame for sanctity spreads. And in the early church, really, it was a case of vox populi, that the local people, they who knew and lived with the person involved, they decided locally that this was a very good person. And that was as far as official canonization went. I'm thinking of many of the early Irish and English saints and so on. You know, they didn't have any kind of official process. It was very local. Now, when we use that kind of the idea of local interest, in the case of most people nowadays who go on the path to sainthood, if we use that term, there are various stages set out, and these have been changed over the years, really. But to be declared venerable, a long account needs to be written up of the person's life, activities, virtues, if you wish, and these have to be examined by a panel of theologians, of historians, and so on. And if they are happy, well, then they present their cause through the local bishop and then on to Rome, that we think that this person is a good candidate, you know, that we could go further in examining their lives, that the evidence seems to point to the fact that they led saintly lives. At that stage, the person is declared venerable. So, like, that's the first hurdle.
After being declared venerable, further evidence is required that the candidate was truly a friend of God. For someone to be pronounced blessed, there must be a miracle performed as a tangible sign of being in a special relationship with God. A further miracle is needed before someone can then be declared a saint.
Usually the type of area that is concentrated on is the medical one, where, you know, medical records can be examined by a panel of doctors and so on. And the results are there. Many of the statistics concerning the health of the person are available. And the opinions of the medical people at the time, they can give a kind of, a measured opinion whether or not they think at the present state of knowledge that that person would have recovered anyway, or whether it seems outside the realms of, you know, the ordinary medical process. So again, usually there are many favours that maybe the people involved in these particular favours would consider are of a miraculous nature. There may, of course, be a whole lot of other factors, and there may indeed be good medical practice. Some doctors sometimes feel a little bit peeved that all the credit seems to go to the Almighty when they have put many hours of, good medical practice into looking after these patients.
Miracles are, of course, only the tip of the iceberg. In considering beatification or canonization, it is more important to see that the candidate's life is relevant to people today. Yet why were medical miracles sought for Blessed Edmund Rice when he was an educator?
If I pray, we'll say, to pass an examination, just to take a very ordinary item, how do I prove, really, that that was a miracle? It's a kind of a difficult one, and it doesn't sound as convincing as somebody who's, we'll say, dying of cancer or whatever, and not alone, like, is the illness cleared up, but even the symptoms sometimes are also removed. I mean, that seems a more startling type of intervention.
How does Brother Donald see the relevance of the life of Blessed Edmund Rice to people today?
When I look at Edmund, I'm not thinking very much about, you know, medical cures. I'm thinking more in the line of young people today. I mean, he spent his whole, or most of his life, dealing with that aspect. How are they coping? How are parents coping with young people? And family matters. He himself was a married man. His wife died very young, left him with a handicapped daughter. And I feel around areas like that, there are many people out there who have crying needs, who have great needs, and to feel at peace when they're praying to a person who has experienced some of their pain, I would suggest.
Finally, the candidate for beatification or canonization must somehow inspire others with an energy and enthusiasm for doing good and for deepening their relationship with God in prayer.
When I see young people, 18 and 19 years of age, coming back from our immersion courses in India and Africa, having spent 2 or 3 weeks working with the really poor in various ministries connected with the brothers in these countries, and see their eyes shining, people who mightn't be inclined to go rushing into churches every other day. I said, Edmund, you've got something going for you there. You've done something right, and you pass some of that on to your followers.